Some 25-year-old friends had a reunion, and they were discussing where they should go for dinner. Somebody suggested they meet at the Glowing Embers restaurant because the waitresses there are young and beautiful. They all agreed. 15 years later, these same guys met and discussed again where they should have dinner. Somebody suggested the Glowing Embers restaurant because the food and wine selection there are very good. They all agreed. Another 15 years later, these same friends got together and once again discussed where to meet. Somebody suggested the Glowing Embers restaurant because the lighting is good there so you can read the menu. And the restaurant had some 55 and over senior discounts. They all agreed. Another 15 years later, at the age of 70, the group discussed where they should meet. Somebody suggested again that they meet at the Glowing Embers restaurant because the restaurant is physically accessible and they even have an elevator. They all agreed. Finally, 15 years later, at the age of 85, the same group of friends discussed one more time where they should meet for dinner. Somebody suggested they should meet at the Glowing Embers restaurant because they had never gone there before. And they all agreed. Now, the only thing worse than losing our physical memory is spiritual forgetfulness. Spiritual forgetfulness. Well, that brings us to the book of Judges this morning. The book of Judges. Judges covers over 350 years of history. And if you've gone through the book of Judges recently, you might say it's a pretty depressing read. But I want you to turn there in your Bibles to the book of Judges, the book of Judges. It's right after Joshua in the Old Testament, the book of Judges. Now, let me review while you're turning to Judges that we're tracing the storyline of the Bible from cover to cover. And so what God is doing is directly tied to the promise given to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 that through him would come a great nation that would be a blessing to all people. And so far in our series, our sights have been on Abraham's descendants becoming that great nation. And we have seen that in order to be a nation, four characteristics are needed. You need lots of people, you need a leader, you need a law to live by, and you need land. Well, God had done amazing things to bring the multitude of people out of Egypt through the leader Moses, then providing them with a way of life, giving them the law. And we left off last week with Joshua leading God's people into the promised land, the land of Canaan. Now they have lands. And it would seem logical that next in our story, you would see Israel thriving. That the people would be celebrating God's power and enjoying God's presence for generations to come. That they'd remember all that God had done for them. That they'd be walking in obedience to the Lord. And tragically, that's not what comes next in our story. As we'll see, things change dramatically for the people of God. Now, the passage that was just read in Judges chapter 2 in verse 10, I want to read that verse, last verse again that Patsy read in verse 2 of chapter 2. It says, after that whole generation, meaning Joshua's generation, had been gathered to their fathers, which is just a nice way of saying they died, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, what about the pile of stones that they set up in Gilgal? I mean, that pile of stones was for them to remember what God had done. It was to be a teaching tool for their children. That when a child would ask, Dad, what do these stones mean? The dad would answer, well, these stones represent what God did for us. And then he'd go on and give a history lesson of the God who delivered them from the Egyptians and brought them into land of their own. Did they pass it on to their children? What went wrong? Well, I want to look this morning, first of all, at the state of the nation. The state of the nation that's going to cover the whole book of Judges. If you've been with us through this series, you know we're doing large chunks here, okay? I'm trying to give you the main storyline. And so I want to look at the book of Judges under this heading of the state of the nation. What is the state of the nation at this time now that they're in the land? Well, you recall that after the death of Moses, God raised up Joshua to be Moses' successor. Well, who does Joshua pass the baton to? Who is Joshua's successor? All right, Judges chapter 1, verse 1. Judges 1, verse 1. It says, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? In other words, they're asking, who will lead us? Who is our leader? All right, what's the state of the nation at this time? Well, the state of the nation, first of all, there's no central leadership. There's no central leadership. Let me give you an example of that, some verses. In Judges 17, verse 6, it says, in those days, Israel had no king. In Judges chapter 18, verse 1, it says, in those days, Israel had no king. In Judges 19, 1, it says, in those days, Israel had no king. The very last verse in Judges chapter 21, verse 25, guess what? It says, in those days, Israel had no king. You go, okay, I get it. Israel has no king. Well, it's evident that following the death of Joshua, there is no successor. They have no leader, and that is very significant. It's very significant. Because from the beginning, after the people got into the land, when the people occupied the land, as we saw last week in Book of Joshua, as they occupied the land, the best that it was at this time was a loose confederation. 12 tribes loosely linked together. There was nothing to draw the people together. They had no leader, which brought disunity. And instead of there being a great nation in the land God gave them, there was tribalism. Each tribe pretty much acting on their own. Each tribe did what was right for them. Leads us to our second characteristic of the state of the nation, is they had no sense of the law. They had no sense of the law. A theme that runs through the time of the judges are these words. Everyone did as he saw fit. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This was an individual problem as well as a corporate assessment. You see, the everyone did as he saw fit way of life and way of thinking is a formula for trouble and pain. And the book of Judges records for us a time in Israel when everybody's just running rampant in sin in the land that they were given. The people of God are in the land promised by God, and things are a mess. Israel is coming very close in this time to chaos. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, might that characterize the times in which we live in? All right, now we see not only no central leadership, no sense of the law, but now we see a cycle that's repeated, a cycle that's repeated. I want you to look with me the verses that following the ones that were just read this morning from Judges chapter 2. The last verse that was read was 10. I want to pick it up in verse 11 of Judges 2. Follow along. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the people around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and Ashtoreths. Verse 14 says, in his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. The end of verse 15 tells us that the people were in great distress. And it's when we're in distress that we then call out to God for help. And that's what the people did. And then God raised up judges, it tells us in verse 16, who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Now, the judges, by the way, they were rulers. They were not kings. They were deliverers who were local and not national in scope. And so they came, they went, they came, they went. They were there for a very temporary reason that once the delivery was done, they left the scene. And then verse 19 tells us, after they cried out and God delivered them, it tells us, verse 19, that when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers. I mean, Judges is just one roller coaster ride. And the cycle repeated was this. The people sinned against the Lord, so God sent disaster their way. And for years, they would be oppressed, and then eventually they would cry out to God for help, and God in his mercy would raise up a judge, a deliverer to rescue them from their oppression. They then would enjoy some time of peace, And then they would forget the Lord again and sin against him. And then he would send some disaster on them. And then they would, after some time, they would cry out to God for help. And he would raise a judge to deliver them from their oppression. Things would be good again. And then they'd sin again. And around it goes. But have you seen that pattern in your life? We cry out to God, God, save me from this. He delivers. We say, thank you, Lord. And then we fall back into our own ways. And so we cry out to God again, and he graciously delivers us. And then we go, thanks, God. I got it from here. I'm all set. I'll let you know when I need you again. Oh, no, I need him again. God, help. He helps because he's so gracious. He helps. And then we go, okay, I got it again. I'm all set. I'll let you know when I need you. Well, what's the state of the nation? Well, and how did they get in this mess? Well, we look at the snare of the Canaanites. The snare of the Canaanites. The Israelites, by the way, were commanded to drive out the people living in Canaan. Back in Deuteronomy 9, 4 and 5, you can just write it down, look at it later. But in Deuteronomy 9, verses 4 and 5, Moses said, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. Now, let me just pause here for a second, and that's all it's really going to be. It's not going to be that long here, but we might be disturbed by God's instructions to his people to wipe out completely all the people living in that land. But listen, it is their wickedness that provoked God to act. The Canaanites were steep in idolatry, steep in immorality, and child sacrifice. I mean, it was awful. And God knows that if the Israelites allow this evil to remain in the land with them, the people and their ways, they will become a snare and a corrupting influence on them for years to come. And that's exactly what happens. That's why Joshua gives them the warning back in Joshua 23, 12 and 13 as they're going into the land. He says, now listen, if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them, they will become snares and traps for you. And that's what we see happen. They failed to completely remove the Canaanites from the land. And so we see this ominous refrain. In 1:19, for example, it says, the Lord was with the men of Judah, that's one of the tribes of Israel, and they took possession of the hill country. Now get this, they were unable to drive the people from the plains. In chapter 1, verse 21, it says the tribe of Benjamin. The Benjamites failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. That to this day, meaning the time of Judges, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. That wasn't supposed to happen. 1:25, the tribe of Joseph. It says they drove out a lot of the people, but they spared one family. They did not drive out all the people. In 1:27, but Manasseh did not drive out the people. We see that refrain again in verse 28, verse 29, verse 30, verse 31, verse 33. See, listen, partial obedience is still disobedience. We say, I'm just going to do part of what God says, that's convenience. That's not obedience. And so when God, for example, tells us in Ephesians 5, get rid of even a hint of sexual immorality, get rid of any kind of impurity, get rid of any greed. Get rid of any form of idolatry in our lives. Let a portion of that remain is to invite trouble. I know I've shared with you before of the Haitian pastor who would tell the story of a certain man who wanted to sell his house for $2,000. Another man wanted to very badly buy it, but because he was poor, he couldn't afford the full price. Well, after much bargaining, the owner agreed to sell the house for half the original price with just one stipulation, that he would retain ownership of one small nail protruding from just over the door, that was still his. Well, after several years, the original owner wanted the house back, but the new owner was unwilling to sell. And so the owner, remembering that he still owned that one small nail just over the door, he says, okay, this is what I'll do. And he went out and he found the carcass of a dead dog, and he hung that from that nail that he still owned. And soon the house, it was a stench, and it became unlivable, and the family was forced to sell the house to the owner of that one nail. And then this Haitian pastor concludes with this. He says, if we leave the devil with even one small peg in our life, he will return to hang his rotting garbage on it, making it unfit for Christ's habitation. You leaving any small pegs? Anything that you're tolerating that kind of keeps tripping you up? Well, the people of God had ownership of the land. Well, most of it. And they allowed some of the Canaanites to remain in the land, that even a small nail would be their undoing. And so the state of the nation, there was severe darkness in the land. There was severe darkness in the land. Now, there aren't many heroes of the faith in the book of Judges. Instead, there's a motley crew who are models of who are not models of godly living. There's Jephthah, who kills his own daughter. There's womanizing Samson, a strong man with a she weakness. Remember Delilah's words? Oh, Samson, how can you say you love me if you won't confide in me? Oh, and he fell for it. He fell for it. Then there are the idols in Micah's house, where adultery seems to be commonplace in those days. And the very last story in the book of Judges tells of it's a gruesome story, it's true though, of a man whose concubine was raped and murdered by a neighboring tribe. And you know what he did? He cut up her body into 12 pieces and mailed them to each of the 12 tribes. He thought TV was bad. There's severe darkness in the land. There's blatant idolatry. There's nasty, gross sexual immorality. And it seems like it's a common thing in those days. And listen, these aren't pagans. These are God's people. It's like we're going off the rails on a crazy train, to quote Ozzy Osbourne's song. He says, I've listened to preachers, I've listened to fools, I've watched all the dropouts who make their own rules. One person conditioned to rule and control, the media sells it, and you live the role. Now here's my picture of Judges. Each generation got progressively worse as they went off the rails on this crazy train. All the people did what was right in their own eyes. That's the very last line of the book of Judges. The big frame shows a world that is out of control, still looking for a solution to the problem of sin. And Judges highlights that need. Things are a complete mess in Israel in the time of Judges. Now, if I said, okay, we're done, go home, you go, well, that was a pretty depressing sermon today. Well, we're about to get a glimpse of hope. God's grace is greater than their sin. There is a bright spot. We come to these words. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Now, do you know where that we find that verse? Do you know what book of the Bible that verse comes from? It comes from the book of Ruth. So look with me, book of Ruth, chapter 1, verse 1 is where that verse is. It's the very next book of the Bible after Judges. It's named after a non-Jew. That should get our attention. Now, here we are in the book of Ruth, and I go, whoa, perfect. Perfect on Valentine's weekend to talk about the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is a very moving story. It has all the elements of a love story. So guys, instead of taking your wife to a chick flick or watching a Hallmark movie, you can sit down and read the book of Ruth together. And all of you going, I'm really concerned for pastor's wife right now, if that's as romantic as he gets. But did you know that the marvelous story of Ruth is set in the promised land during the time of Judges? That if we think the main purpose of Ruth is romance, we have missed the point. Because Ruth is more than a love story. And it's difficult to pin down exactly when Ruth was written. Some say around the 10th chapter of Judges, but we don't really know. But the story of Ruth was during the time that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That was the state of the nation. Well, here's the bright spot. Here's the bright spot, Book of Ruth. Ruth is a ray of sunshine in the sea of darkness. It was a bright spot in dark times. And in just 85 verses, we follow one family and a foreign woman named Ruth as they seek to live out difficult days of the judges. And this true story takes very unexpected twists and turns. I mean, there are setbacks, there's a glimpse of hope, followed by another setback, followed by some more hope. So I want to track some of that. I want to first look at the first setback. And the first setback in the book of Ruth is a famine. There's a famine going on. And verse 2 of Ruth chapter 1, follow along, it tells us that Naomi and her husband and two sons, what do they must do? Leave their homeland in Judah on account of what? A famine. Kind of a famine. Now, this family was living in the promised land in the town of Bethlehem. Ironically, Bethlehem means house of bread. The house of bread has no bread, so they go and live in a foreign country of Moab. Now, the background of Moab and Moabite is really important, because the Moabite was a descendant of Lot. The beginning of the Moabites was when Lot had an incestuous relationship with his daughter in Genesis 19. And so there's this great division between the Moabites and the Israelites. And so recorded for us was one incident, by the way, of when Moabite women seduced Israelite men into sexual immorality and all kinds of idolatry. God brings judgment on them, and 24,000 people are struck down and killed. See, Moab was a place where the women were known for sexual immorality. It was a place known for idolatry and worship of false gods. They were the enemies of the people of God in Israel. And so one man from the people of God takes his family, turns his back on the land God promised, and he goes to live in Moab, of all places. Now, we come to the next setback, great loss. Great loss. Add grief to famine here. And Ruth chapter 1, verses 3 through 5, it sums up a 10-year nightmare. There's one tragedy after another, one setback after another. Pick it up with me in verse 3 of Ruth 1. 1:3. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. And after they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. I can't imagine the devastation of losing your spouse and then losing one child, much less two. Not to mention the financial struggles that she had and during time of famine in the land where they came from. And so she had no husband, she had no children, and she had no grandchildren. And she was aging and past childbearing years, and there's no sign of her ever getting married again or having children. And so you kind of read that and you go, man, our hearts kind of go out to her. They ought to. Now what would she do? How's she going to make it? I mean, when you're in that kind of situation, is there anything really even to live for? Are you experiencing loss right now? I mean, do you know real hurt? You brought it into this worship time this morning, and you've got hurt and loss and you go, I don't know how to make it. A while back, for a counseling course I was taking, I read a book called The Grace Disguised by Jerry Sitzer. It's an excellent book, by the way, on dealing with loss in our lives. And Jerry isn't writing as one removed from experiencing loss, because in a moment's time, Jerry lost three generations in a car accident when a drunk driver struck the minivan he was driving. And the car with him were his mother, his wife, and small daughter. They were all killed. In this powerful book, he tells of his loss and process of that and the experiencing of grief. But he describes the initial experience of living with a loss in a very poignant way. He says this. He goes, I felt like I was staring at the stump of a huge tree that had just been cut down in my backyard. That stump, which sat all alone, kept reminding me of the beloved tree I had lost. I could think of nothing but that tree, and every time I looked out the window, all I could see was that stump. And likely some of you are here today, and you know exactly that feeling. You're looking out the window of your life, and all you can see is that bare stump. And Sitzer later says he discovered that the experience of loss does not need to be the defining moment of your life. Instead, he says, the defining moment can be our response to the loss. In other words, he says, we don't have the freedom to choose the roles we must play in life, but we can choose how we're going to play the roles that we have been given. Loss is hard to swallow. You need to maybe choose a different role or response to your loss today. Well, for Naomi, she saw her life as very bitter and that it was God who was responsible. And what I love about Naomi, I'll take Naomi's any day, she was honest about her hurt. She didn't come and say, oh, all is fine, I'm good. No, no. She said, I don't get any of this. I'm bitter. My soul's bitter. God took these people away from me. And at least she had a high view of her God. She knew God held all things in his control. She knew that he was a great God, mighty in power. And like the man Job, her mindset was that God gives, God takes away. And for her time at this time, God had taken all that she had. And her heart hurt because God's providence is sometimes very, very hard. Well, there's a glimmer of hope in this. There's a glimmer of hope in this. They head home. And verse 6 tells us, of chapter 1, when she, Naomi, heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her two daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. And so they head back home to Judah. And the rest of the chapter, chapter 1, is devoted to how God gave Ruth to Naomi. And Naomi does everything she can to persuade Ruth to return to Moab. Find a husband there. Move on with your life. Don't follow me into Judah. It's hopeless for you, Ruth, to stay with me and remain committed to the family name because it's not going to happen. And with some slight humor, at least that's kind of how I look at it, she even says to Ruth, even if I get pregnant now, which wasn't even likely, she isn't married, Naomi, and she's getting up there in age. But she says, hypothetically speaking now, Ruth, if I get pregnant as of now, I have a son, would you, Ruth, wait around for that son to grow up and as to custom, marry that son? Probably not. Now, behind the scenes, God is working. He has preserved a kinsman to continue Naomi's line. So God must have Ruth stay with Naomi. He works in Ruth, a Moabite woman, to say this in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. She said, Ruth says to Naomi, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And then it says that Ruth clung to Naomi. She wasn't going anywhere. You see, when God wants to get something done, he'll get it done. He can use an ordinary woman like Ruth to cling to her mother-in-law that can alter everything else to come. God is moving in the tragedies of a single family for his purposes. And so we come to another glimmer of hope. There's a harvest coming as they return back to Judah. There's a harvest coming. And in chapter 2, we're let in on something that Naomi apparently had forgotten about. She had a relative on her husband's side whose name was Boaz. Now, remember this. I believe Ruth was written to help us see the fingerprints of God even when our circumstances are bitter. God has a way, doesn't he, of sending postcards our way that says, I haven't forgotten you. Here it is. Well, he sends one to Naomi, and Naomi and Ruth, they return home right at harvest time. So she sends Ruth out to the fields to pick up some grain that's been left behind for those who are less fortunate. And look what it says in chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 2, verse 3. It says, so Ruth went out, began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. Now get this. As it turned out, or literally happened to happen. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. It just so happened that Ruth would land in the very field belonging to Boaz, and Boaz was a close relative of Elimelech. Huh, what a coincidence. Accident? Heard the story of a cowboy who applied for health insurance. And as the agent was making his way through a marathon list of questions, he asked the cowboy, "Have you had any accidents?" The cowboy replied, "Nope, no accidents at all. I mean, I was bitten last year by a rattlesnake, and a horse kicked me in the ribs. I mean, that did lay me up for a while." Well, the agent responded with a confused look on his face, and he said, "Well, wouldn't you call those accidents?" "Why, no," said the cowboy. "They both did it on purpose." Well, there are no accidents with God. None. He does it on purpose. He's got it. And I know that can kind of come across as cliche. But pause to consider that God is moving all the parts in this true account of Ruth. Can you trust that God is moving all the pieces in your life as well? Can I trust that? Well, God makes sure that Boaz was attracted to Ruth, and he makes sure that Ruth is treated well, and Ruth goes home with a boatload of barley. Naomi realizes that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer, a close relative of her husband's who could buy back the land and redeem their name in Israel. And so Boaz is attracted to Ruth, but Boaz doesn't make any move on Ruth. For whatever that's worth. And so Naomi, the mother-in-law, she's going to help things along a little bit. So she gets Ruth to Boaz's room while he is sleeping, and Ruth is to lift the blanket off of his feet. Now, there's a lot to be said, and a lot of people want to chime in on what that's all about. I just think she lifted the blanket off his feet to wake him up. And it's probably a lot more ladylike than kind of nudging him or throwing water on his face. Ruth then has this conversation with Boaz to convince him to be the one who would buy back the family's inheritance and family name. And Ruth strategically and boldly suggests to Boaz that she be the one to whom he make a marriage covenant. She, in essence, proposes to him. Boaz likes what she's insinuating, and Ruth's the kind of woman he wants to marry. This is going well. However, Boaz is an honest man, and he makes Ruth and Naomi aware that there's another man who's actually a closer relative than he is. And he says, "Hey, we kind of need to check with him first." Just when Naomi thought things were getting better, there was a man for Ruth, there's another setback. A closer relative. And chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there." Now, by the way, it was the town gate where business kind of matters would take place. So there is Boaz. He's at the town gate. And verse 1 goes on to say, "When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, 'Come over here, my friend, and sit down.' So he went over and sat down." And I think to myself, this other guy doesn't even get his name mentioned. The narrator doesn't say his name, and neither does Boaz. He says, "My friend," which is another way of saying Mr. So-and-so. Or whatever your name is. That's all he gets. Now, I want to make sure that we understand this whole kinsman redeemer thing that's going on here, because we don't use that term. I had this past week. But in Leviticus 25, verse 24, just check it out. Write it down, Leviticus 25, 24. God had provided for the redemption of land. Now, listen, land was everything in that day. And so there was a provision for the land to stay within the family, or at least within the clan, if that land was lost because of famine or poverty or death. If the land was lost, then there was a means set up by God for a kinsman, the nearest adult relative, to come and redeem, buy back that land, to keep that land in the family. Now also jot down Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. Those verses speak to how God set up a way for a widow to be provided for to make sure that the family's name is carried on. Again, a kinsman, nearest adult relative, must take the widow and family in through marriage. All right, that's the background. So Boaz meets with his closer relative, and he lays the situation out before him. And he says, well, you know, Naomi here has this little property. She doesn't really have much, but she it's your duty as the nearest kinsman. You need to come and buy it so that the inheritance stays in the family. And this unnamed person goes, that's a no-brainer. It's an offer the guy can't refuse. And he says, I will redeem it. We don't want him to redeem it. We want Boaz to do it. If you're reading this for the first time, you're going to go, no, this isn't how it's supposed to work. We want Boaz to marry Ruth. And you kind of go, what was Boaz thinking? Did he really have to be that honest here? Was it worth it to give up Ruth to Mr. So-and-so? And just when we think it is going to end how we want it to end, Boaz has got this. He jumps in and he says, oh, yeah, by the way, Mr. So-and-so, I forgot to mention this one other detail. Naomi has a daughter-in-law, and she comes with the deal. And to do your part as a kinsman redeemer, you must also take Ruth as your wife, because Naomi is past childbearing years, so the children must come through the other widow, Ruth, and you. Oh, yeah, one other thing. Ruth is a Moabite woman. Remember that group, he might say? Remember that group of people that caused 24,000 Israelites to be struck down because of the Moabite women and what they were doing? Yeah, she's one of those. Now, he said, no offense to Ruth, he says, but the kinsman says, well, forget it then. This kinsman backs out of the deal, leaving the property, leaving Ruth to Boaz. And everyone goes, aw. You didn't have to. At least you're with me. Now, there's another glimmer of hope here. It's the story within the story. The story within the story. In this book, you have a whole chapter describing bitter circumstances of one family. In this book, you have a whole chapter describing a day in the field. In this book, you have a whole chapter describing a couple of hours one night, and then you have one verse, you have a wedding and a baby. Chapter 4, verse 13. Chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Now, while it's been obvious throughout this book that God was working, the narrator wants to make sure we don't miss seeing this here, what God did, Yahweh God did, in opening up her womb so that she could conceive, that God alone meets the deepest needs we have in our lives. You see, it was God who gave Ruth to Naomi. It was God who gave Boaz to Ruth, and it was God who gave child to Ruth and Boaz. Who would have thought that Naomi, who came back to Bethlehem with honest hurt, who had lost everything she loved and had, returns home with nothing but a Moabite daughter-in-law that now she has a grandson in her arms. But this is more than a just feel-good story. This is more than Ruth and her shining armor, Boaz, riding out into the sunset in love. This is about a God who, in the middle of one of the darkest times in history, providing a way for the greatest king in our history. See, God will prepare a king through a Moabitess woman. For the middle of verse 17 of chapter 4 says, Naomi has a son. They named him Obed. Obed? Who's Obed? Oh, it's going to tell us. Obed was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Ruth is David's grandmother. Ruth, the Moabite, is responsible for bringing David into the world, who would be king of Israel. Oh, and that's not all. We need to lift our eyes to see the bigger picture, the storyline that God is writing. There is a story that goes beyond a cute baby and a happy grandmother. You see, the story points forward to David, and David points forward to Jesus, and Jesus points forward to a future resurrection, and that points us forward to the best is yet to come. Who would have thought that Ruth, serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning in a field, falling in love, having a baby, would somehow be part of something much bigger? Who would have thought? And this wasn't simply about blessing Naomi with a grandchild. This was God orchestrating it all to bring about the greatest king that Israel would ever have, David. And the name David, who would bring with him the hope of the Messiah. See, this little book, Ruth, it's all about hope. That no matter how out of control your life might seem right now, or the world that you think is just absolutely in complete chaos and out of control, there's always a glimmer of hope. I mean, did Boaz, Ruth, and Naomi have any idea that their impact of their ordinary lives in such dark times would have for all of redemptive history? See, the word to us then is this. If that's all true, the word to us is this. Let's not be okay with trivial pursuits of life. We live for something bigger, much bigger than ourselves and what we see. We are created for something much greater than football, 401ks, summers in the lakes region, skiing on the slopes, or any other temporal affections. We can be part of the grand scheme of redemptive history right here. Howie was from a broken home. His parents separated before he was born and left him to be raised by his grandmother in Philadelphia. This is a true story. He often wandered from tavern to tavern looking for his alcoholic grandfather. One day, 9-year-old Howie was sprawled out on Philadelphia's sidewalk playing marbles with his friends. And suddenly this awkward-looking guy was standing beside them, all 6 feet, 4 inches of him. Howie looked up at him with his mouth open, and the man said to Howie, "Hey, how would you like to go to Sunday school?" Howie thought, well, that's a very unfortunate question, because in his mind, anything that had the word school in it had to be bad news. So Howie shook his head, no. But this man, Walt, well, he was just getting started. "Well, how would you like to play marbles?" he asked, and he squatted down. Now he's talking Howie's language. As the best marble player on the block, he felt supremely confident he could whip this man fairly easily. Well, Walt went on to beat Howie in every single game. Even though he took every one of his marbles and a little of his pride, he gained something infinitely more important, the friendship of a man who really cared. You see, Walt took an interest in all those boys. He challenged them to a few games of marbles. He beat them at it, and he taught them how to play better. But eventually, there were 13 boys off the streets of Philadelphia who attended Walt's Sunday school class. 9 were from broken homes. And even though Walt never went beyond high school, 11 of those 13 boys went on to vocational Christian service, becoming pastors, missionaries, seminary professors. You see, God was accomplishing his purpose by using an ordinary man who obeyed him. One of those men who was impacted and influenced was the man named Howard Hendricks, who later became a prominent professor at Dallas Seminary, and he was an extraordinary man who had a worldwide impact for Christ. See, the beautiful thing is, God used an ordinary man named Walt who obeyed him to reach Dr. Hendricks. Who knows the difference your one act of devotion can make? Our ordinary lives can be used for God. May God use us here at EBC, an ordinary church filled with ordinary people for his purposes, his redemptive purposes. How can you be that bright spot in a dark world this week? Let's pray.